It's Wednesday, January 13th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. We have a lot to talk about this week, like Sean Penn's interview with drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, 7 hours in a Mexican jungle. It yielded an 11,000-word piece for Rolling Stone. The actor turned activist says he has nothing to fear among questions of harboring the fugitive, whether he should have done the interview for free, and if Guzman ever should have been given editorial approval. Making a Murderer, some are now calling it the new serial, where a nation gripped by the tale of Stephen Avery, a Wisconsin man who served 18 years for sexual assault that he didn't commit, only to be convicted of murder in 2007. We're going to talk about the Netflix documentary, about Stephen Avery's case, and about the role of journalists in it. And we'll talk about a couple of pieces of legislation under consideration in Jefferson City that could mean big changes for journalists. One limits access and rights, the other could do exactly the opposite. We'll talk about both of them. There's a lot more, hopefully we'll get to as well, but we're going to start with what on the face of it looks like a sports story, but in reality is so much more. Just as President Obama was starting his State of the Union address last night, I got a breaking news push alert. The NFL owners had voted, and the Rams are moving. They will be the Los Angeles Rams with the start of the 2016 season. Here's team owner Stan Kroenke, followed by Andy Cohen on Watch What Happens Live on Bravo TV.
It is bittersweet. We understand the emotions involved of our fans. And it's not easy to do these things. They are purposefully made hard. But we're here today. We made a decision and worked long and hard at the various alternatives. When they didn't succeed, we worked this one to this point.
Today's Jackal goes to Stan Kroenke, the greedy owner of the St. Louis Rams, who is moving the team to Los Angeles. He called St. Louis struggling, but interestingly enough, the Wall Street Journal last week named it the number one sports town in America. Mm-hmm. When this jackass said he wanted a new stadium, St. Louis offered him a $1.1 billion open-air stadium, but he still decided to leave.
Wow.
I can forgive the hairpiece that makes Donald Trump's look normal, but I can't forgive this.
Yeah.
Hey, Kroenke, as a proud St. Louisan, I want to give you something on behalf of my hometown.
Oh,
that's for you, buddy.
Yeah.
Stan, see it?
Yeah,
there you go.
So it must be huge loss.
Only 36 days till pitchers and catchers report to spring training.
What did Andy Cohen give him? He gave him the finger, two of them, actually. This morning, the front pages say it all. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch carries a banner headline reading, "Goodbye, Rams." The LA Times headline, "NFL returns to LA, Rams kick off in 16. Saturday night, quiet time, seldom news breaking. Monday night.
This is a long time coming. It's, you know, the Rams and the situation with Kroenke dates back to when he first pulled out the contract and said, hey, the contract states that you owe us, meaning the Rams, a palatial arena. So either you upgrade this or you build us another one, but otherwise we can opt out of the contract and move. And, you know, they talked about it for over 10 years and the governor put together a task force and they came up with these renditions and $1 billion and all this financing that they worked out, and they even actually had naming rights with National Car Rental, and Kroenke was still, nope, I'm going to LA. Mm-hmm. So I don't think anyone's surprised. I just think that they're upset, put it that way, in St. Louis.
I mean, there's plenty of emotion involved, not only for people who are fans of the Rams, but a lot of journalists who covered the Rams. I mean, look at some of the pieces that you posted on our Links blog, and one of the columnists for the Post-Dispatch, Ben Fredrickson, said, "A liar can't help but lie," pointing out that Kroenke is a native Missourian and had promised for a long time that he'd take care of the Rams. But, you know, it's as Ernest said, it's really all about money. The St. Louis deal that they put together was never going to rival Kroenke's three $3 billion stadium in L.A. that was going to include hotels and all kinds of other amenities. And for the NFL, one, they're going to be back in the second largest media market, which they've been out of for 20 years. And two, Kroenke's going to have the NFL's media operations ensconced in that facility. So it was there was never a chance St. Louis was going to win that deal.
And the main thing about it was that the NFL wanted back in L.A. They've been wanting back in L.A. pretty much since the Rams left, and they just couldn't figure out a way to make it happen. And L.A. has, I mean, L.A. has this policy where they aren't going to build you a stadium. If you want a stadium, you're going to have to figure out a way to build it yourself. Kroenke was able to figure out how to do that, and thus he's going back to L.A. The NFL is going back to L.A. They're in that huge television market. There's huge merchandising available in there. And it's not just the Rams. You got the Chargers or the Raiders are going to move in there too. So now you've got, you're going to have these two teams in LA. And that just makes much more money for Kroenke, much more money for the NFL.
And Kroenke did make in his comments and also in the documents that they filed with the NFL, some points that you really can't dispute. I mean, it is true that the Rams were an LA team before St. Louis took them 20 years ago. It's true St. Louis is struggling economically, so as a media market, there are problems there. And frankly, it's true in that Andy Cohen piece you showed kind of alluded to it. St. Louis is really a baseball town. I mean,
it's a baseball town. It's a hockey town.
They were right. Fans. There were plenty of fans of the Rams, even when they were doing horribly, which they have for most of the 20 years that they've been in St. Louis. But there are some economic realities that would lead any rational billionaire to want to move their team somewhere else.
And it's one of those things is when you get a football franchise from another area. Mm-hmm. You always run any kind of sports franchise, you always run the risk of that franchise moving somewhere else, which is why Houston fought to get its own expansion team and not have a team move in. And that's one of the things that I think towns need to really be careful about is get an expansion team. Don't get another team
because
to move
a team
in.
That moves has a legacy of moving. They're,
exactly.
They're not committed to staying where they
exactly.
are.
And in fact, as Jim Thompson Thomas, I think it was pointed out in the Post Dispatch, he's looking back at the history of all this. St. Louis tried to get an expansion team before they had to quote settle for the Rams, but they lost out on that deal.
Right. Right.
Okay. Well, Saturday night, quiet time, seldom big news breaking, especially on the media beat. Well, not this week because that's when Rolling Stone dropped its latest get. Actor Sean Penn's exclusive interview with Joaquin El Chapo Guzman.
Quiero dejar en claro el contenido de esta entrevista.
We now know that the two men met in a clearing in a Mexican jungle for 7 hours back in October when El Chapo was still on the lam. The drug kingpin told the actor turned activist he started growing and selling drugs as a means of survival for him and for his family going back to his mid-teens, and that like any entrepreneur, he worked to grow his business into a billion-dollar empire. It sounds noble, no?
Well, you know, I have to say this. Any journalist yeah. who had an opportunity to interview El Chapo would have taken that, right? And they would have, you know, agreed not to give his whereabouts to law enforcement. Some might have even agreed, you know, to let him have some sort of editorial control over the product. But I have to say, I mean, the rationale that Sean Penn had in his own mind for why it was okay that he put in this rambling 11,000-word article in Rolling Stone is kind of troubling if you ask me. I mean, he basically says, I'm aware of all the people that El Chapo has killed or had killed. I'm familiar with all the drug agents and soldiers who have died as a result of this, all the people whose lives have been ruined by drugs. But, you know, then he says, I took some comfort in the fact that he's a businessman first and only resorts to violence when he deems it advantageous to himself or his business interests. Well, he may take comfort in that. I'm not sure any of those victims would take comfort in it, and I'm not sure we should either.
Well, it's kind of funny. When I was on the way into the office, I was listening to the radio, and apparently NBC News reported that El Chapo really wanted to meet the actress,
yes.
the Mexican actress, who
I believe is on a bunch of telenovelas. Or
exactly,
something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who basically brokered this meeting, and he was more interested in her and didn't even know who Sean Penn was.
Didn't know Jeff Spicoli. The drug kingpin didn't know Jeff Spicoli.
This is what they're reporting. So you know, Sean Penn shows up and he decides, okay, you know, I got to meet her. Yes, I'll give you this interview. What's going to become of it? What they're saying is that he really had no idea that it was going to be in Rolling Stone or any of this. So, I mean, I find the whole thing fascinating. It's almost like this becomes the ending of the movie that maybe Sean Penn was thinking about when he went to go do the interview.
The crazy tale of the starstruck
drug kingpin.
Well, and truthfully, it says something about sort of the celebrity factor bringing down the drug kingpin, that he wanted to have this biopic made about him in the first place, to the point that he had to know that the actress was probably going to be followed. And the Mexican authorities, they certainly were anxious to leak those photographs showing that that's exactly what they did. They had pictures of the actress and Sean Penn meeting at the airport. So, you know, it was only a matter of time before he was caught again, because he valued the celebrity and meeting this actress apparently more than his own safety.
Yeah. And now that you have this huge push to have him extradited to the United States. And I think part of that is because not only does the United States not trust the Mexicans to hang on to him, I'm starting to think that the Mexicans don't trust themselves to hang on to him. So it's like, we got to get him out of here.
So all of these factors coming together and having this bizarre comedic sense to it. There's still some serious journalism issues that went on here too that have people talking. First, the idea of Rolling Stone having the editor's note at the top of Sean Penn's piece that says that El Chapo Guzman was given editorial approval on the story, and why they would do that in any case.
I think it's a violation of the basic ethical tenets that most journalists and most news organizations follow. Not all of them, but most of them do, that you don't give prior approval to a story. You might let them see their quotes for accuracy or things like that, but you don't just say, sure, you want to edit it? Go right ahead. Now, he didn't. Does that somehow forgive the Rolling Stone for making that decision? I don't know. It was still an interesting interview. The problem I have with it is not the Rolling Stone necessarily gave some sort of theoretical granting of editing privileges, mm-hmm. but that they didn't edit this piece itself. I mean, Sean Penn wrote this horrible, rambling, self-referential kind of piece that, I mean, you would have expected that, but I think you could have gotten a lot more out of it if you'd had a more traditional journalistic approach to that piece.
But I have to give Rolling Stone some credit. At least they were transparent about the fact that this is what we did.
Yeah.
How many times have we sat around this table and talked about news organizations that haven't been transparent about the fact that they
haven't been sitting around this table?
And frankly, no ordinary journalist would have probably gotten that interview. Only Sean Penn, and only because he was associated with the actress, did that interview.
So, Ernest, let me ask you this then. So you're giving Rolling Stone some credit for the transparency there. There are a whole lot of people who were coming down really hard on Rolling Stone, too, that this is, you know, what, 6 or 8 months after the whole UVA rape case story. And that idea of, like, you can't even say that Rolling Stone had a bad year, because that was 2015. This is 2016.
Well, I mean, I'm with Mike. I agree with what Mike is saying in terms of the fact that the piece was rambling, I'm not comfortable at all with them giving him, you know, giving El Chapo carte blanche to change the story or to view the story and that sort of thing.
And boy, isn't it good that he liked it as it was turned in.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not agreeing with that. I mean, I think that's against journalistic principles. What I'm saying is that at least in this case, as opposed to previous cases, Rolling Stone told the readers up front, this is what we did.
There was one other little hidden piece in there that some journalists were really upset about, that Sean Penn said that when he commits acts of journalism, he does them for free. He doesn't do it for pay. And that at a time when so many journalists are finding themselves downsized or in buyouts or being asked to write and to have their work credited through links and getting paid in prestige, that somebody going out and doing this and doing it for free is just kind of making it harder on the real, air quotes, real journalists out there.
Well, it's easy to do it for free when you've made millions of dollars
as
an actor. But, you know, come on, journalists. I mean, you know, do what you do. And if you do it well, odds are that you will get paid for doing it. And you can't really blame Rolling Stone for saying, here's a great opportunity and he's doing it for free. I would take that if I were an editor.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, Mike, maybe you can answer this question. I mean, was this something that Sean Penn did and knowing that it was going to go into Rolling Stone, or did he shop it around after he did it? I mean, I'm not.
According to his piece, he took it to Wenner, to Jan Wenner, the publisher of Rolling Stone, after he'd made the arrangements, you know, to do the interview in the first place.
Well, I mean, in that regard, then Rolling Stone knew what it was getting into. Sean Penn could have probably asked for, mm-hmm. for some sort of, you know, funding for it or money for it, and they probably would have said, sure, here you go. And so, I mean, the whole fact that he did it and he didn't get paid doesn't really bother me. What bothers me is that the way the whole thing was set up, the fact that the story was rambling and didn't really delve deep into it, you allowed this basically drug kingpin murderer to
give him a megaphone and a platform.
Give him a megaphone and a platform, and it was not hard hitting and substantive in a way that would have been done had a real journalist done it. However, if a real journalist had done it, the question becomes: would he or she be alive to tell
the story.
I could even say from one sympathetic...
Maybe if they had the novella star.
Right.
One sympathetic standpoint. Penn makes a point that a lot of other people have made that, you know, the consumers of drugs have some culpability for the drug trade and the killings and all that. But to have
that.
Sean Penn make that argument in the way he did, I think pretty much erases the credibility of it.
Okay. Well, we have long since established that I'm not exactly what you would call hip. Until this past weekend, I'd never seen a single Star Wars movie, much to the chagrin of my colleagues here. Well, that changed because Ernest said if Mike and I wanted to talk about making a murderer, I had to watch Star Wars. And I did. So we're going to talk about it. The Netflix documentary is the talk of the nation. It's the story of Stephen Avery, a Manitowoc County man released from prison after serving 18 years for a sexual assault he didn't commit. He sued local authorities that he says framed him once, and then this happened.
Do we have a body or anything yet?
I don't believe so.
We have Stephen Avery in custody, though.
Are you kidding me?
The disappearance of Teresa Halbach remains a mystery.
Mr. Avery's blood is found inside of Teresa Halbach's vehicle.
Steve, everybody's listening. What do you want to say today?
I'm innocent.
If convicted, Stephen Avery will spend the rest of his life in prison.
We found a key.
That key was scrubbed and his DNA was placed on it.
This is really strange.
What's going on here?
Halbach's last stop Monday was at Stephen Avery's home.
If he did this, maybe it was good he was in prison all that time.
Everything I've heard him say hasn't been the truth.
It was extraordinarily disturbing.
We went through this 20 years ago, and we're going through it now again.
In this criminal justice system, good luck.
You are probably the most dangerous individual ever to set foot in this courtroom.
The truth always comes out.
I've seen it. It's a gripping 10 hours. But before we get into the little nuances, let me ask you, what were your reactions? What did you think of it?
Well, I mean, first of all, it was a triumph for Netflix. I mean, you talk about them getting people to change their viewing habits by binge watching something. I did the same thing. Over two nights, I watched all 10 hours. It was an extremely well-produced documentary. It took advantage of some precedents set by Serial and The Jinx on HBO and our fascination with true crime. There are a lot of production values. There was a lot of commitment. These documentarians spent 10 years mm-hmm. working on this thing, and it shows on the product that you finally see on the screen. It raises a lot of really interesting questions about the judicial system that I think we can talk about and the media's ability to guarantee somebody or not guarantee somebody, but to make sure somebody does not get a fair trial by the way we prejudice juries.
I just started watching it. So I'm not, and I'm not good at binge watching television. So it's going to take
me a while.
Well,
then you're going to be one of the few who watch Making a Murderer over time.
Over time. Exactly. But I think Mike is absolutely right. It does raise the question of what is the media's culpability in hurting the jury pool, in sort of framing the story where the person is, the whole innocence thing becomes sort of lost because, I mean, the person is deemed guilty if you're just watching the way in which the media covers it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good part of it as well. I kind of wish that there was some way that we could actually, and when I say we, I'm talking about the media, cover crime in a way that shows the narrative in its totality and not in these little bitty pieces, because I think this does that. But it's a lot of hard work, and it's a lot
even in its totality, though, it still had to have been edited down to 10 hours, means in trials and in hearings that went on for weeks at a time with hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of evidence entered into the record, we still aren't getting everything in that 10 hours. And that's what's leading to some of the criticism here of this as well, that maybe he did do it, but the way the documentarians framed the story,
first of all,
may have taken some of that context away, too.
There is an argument to be made there. And the prosecutor, the former prosecutor, who himself is somewhat disgraced these days after a sexting scandal, but he did make the case that there was evidence the documentarians left out that would have made Avery seem more culpable, more guilty. I mean, for example, they had testimony from a friend of the victim who said she was afraid to go out there because of past encounters with him. There was evidence that Avery may have disguised who was asking for the photographer, the victim, to come out there in order to get her there. And there was a lot of other evidence as well that wasn't presented in the documentary. Now, as you say, though, 100 and some hours of just the court testimony alone, plus all the videotape of the interrogations, on and on and on. It's a daunting challenge for journalists in real time to cover these stories fairly when you can't even really do it in 10 hours and over 10 years without a lot of people criticizing what you've done.
And I also think that it's going to take some serious educating of the American public on the way in which our judicial system works, because the way in which we see it in documentaries and dramas and that sort of thing is we see the gripping testimony.
It's not just like Law and Order.
And a lot of people think they know the legal system.
I ask that sarcastically, for the record, everybody.
No, but there are a lot of people who think they understand the justice system based on Law and Order and those kinds of shows. Yeah. When in fact, if you've really been involved in it and really covered it, you see it totally differently than the way in which the general public sees it.
I do think there were two issues, at least, whether you think he was guilty or not guilty, whether you thought the documentary was biased or not biased. There were two things that were raised in Making a Murderer that I think are really troubling and that the media need to pay more attention to. I mean, one is this whole notion of how we accept so-called scientific evidence into trial. For example, he was exonerated after 18 years in prison by DNA evidence, but he was also convicted, at least in part, by the testimony of an FBI agent using a very questionable test on blood evidence that may or may not have been planted. And then the other issue is just this whole notion of how we treat juveniles or people with limited capacity when they're being interrogated by police and giving confessions. I mean, thankfully, the state of Wisconsin requires those interrogations to be videotaped. But Avery's nephew, who was also convicted, I mean, basically everything that could go wrong in terms of tainting the trial or giving this young man an unfair trial happened with the way he was interrogated.
And to me, you would think that the public would know based on what happened, you know, with OJ, which there's a series coming out on that in the next couple of months, on what happened in the OJ trial.
A dramatization,
not a documentary.
Okay.
But you know, the what you're having with that, so many trials that have been tainted by either evidence being planted or tests that aren't as reliable as we may claim, whole problems with entire FBI labs or state forensic labs that have had to go back and look at cases all over again. You would think that when we're at this point, that journalists would question all evidence that's brought in to look at whether or not it's been verified and is actually true and works for either the prosecution or the defense.
And I think journalists do have a responsibility here. I mean, they've certainly gotten a lot of coverage, ratings, eyeballs because of the release of this over the holidays when there was not a lot of news going on, right? And because of what the media did not do to cover this story very well back in the day, I mean, I think there's some responsibility for us to look into things like, what are the laws in your state with regard to whether or not confessions are videotaped, whether or not cameras can be allowed in the courtroom. I mean, there's some stories to
be
told.
And for all of the questionable things that may have gone on in this case, that is one thing to say about the Wisconsin justice system, is that because there are cameras in the courtroom, this one story is able to be out there and to give us reason to question and to look at it deeper. Well, let's bring this all a little bit closer to home and talk about two pieces of legislation under consideration in Jefferson City. The first, making its way through the Senate, would limit access to the floors of the legislative chambers to reporters. The claim here is lawmakers don't want reporters being down there hearing or overhearing conversations, taking something out of context and starting to report based on what they might hear.
Well, I mean, the part of the problem is that's the people's chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And if reporters are there to cover the legislative session and talk to the legislature, they need to have access to that. Now, that means that legislators may need to go into an office, go into a side hall to have a private conversation. That's fine. But when you're on the floor, you're conducting the people's business, and reporters should have access to that.
Like
any other public space for any public citizen, not just reporters.
I'm somewhat conflicted about this. I mean, first of all, the rationale given by the leader of the Senate was that last year a reporter sitting at that table tweeted a private conversation between two senators, and that's a violation of protocol and a violation of the agreement that journalists have for working there. On the other hand, I once covered the Missouri Senate and sat at that very table way, way, way back in the day. It's been there for a long time, and it's there so that reporters can observe what the senators are doing, can have access to the senators' quickly, all the technology is in place. Yes, they are going to try to find a new space for them that's not on the floor of the Senate. Yes, the U.S. Capitol doesn't allow journalists down there on the floor of the Senate. But I really think that the punishment doesn't fit the crime of that one journalist.
Okay, the other law, it's one that might be a little bit more nuanced. It comes from Representative Elijah Haar. He wants to see the rights of student journalists expanded.
If you're cutting your teeth in your high school or college journalism, unless there's a very significant reason why the school should exercise prior restraint, and we lay those out in the bill, I think those journalists should be entitled to the same protection.
Davis says the protection helped clear up the air following the controversy in Columbia last year.
Don't fret over everything that a kid says or every story a kid covers that might not sit well with the higher-ups. Let's let the kids have a voice.
So that was a high school journalism teacher there. The idea is that this would basically overturn the U.S. Supreme Court decision of Hazelwood that gives administrators an opportunity to read or have prior review of a high school or a student publication.
Well, I mean, I'm not a fan of Hazelwood, yeah. But I think in the right circumstances, if school administrators understand First Amendment right, what the students are trying to do, that sort of thing, it's not going to hurt or bring safety issues involving the school. I think that they should be engaged with the journalism teacher, with the students, and trying to determine what's in the best interest of them as journalists, but also the school as a whole. So I think we really need to work on that a little bit more.
Okay, well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. We encourage you to read more about the topics we talked about on today's program. You can check that out on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. These are all great ways to listen to our program again. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Views on KBIA. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to KBIA's Kyle Felling for handling the audio for us. I'm Amy Simons. Thanks again for joining us. We'll be with you again next week for another edition of Views of the News.